Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. But this is not just any edition. This is the 300th episode of this lecture series. And not to mention just a bit after the 10th anniversary. It began in 2009. And, of course, I need to thank primarily the people at the Voice of Reason who really wanted me to be a radio host. I never even thought of that before. I was not a radio host. I just do lectures. And I initially turned them down. Mike Connor, who disappeared. My argument was that academic stuff wouldn't come across very well on the radio. And they said, that's not true. There's a lot large market waiting for things like this. You're one of the few who could really pull it off. And so they did something pretty brilliant. They sent me the equipment, a very expensive microphone and headphones. And they knew me well enough to know that I'd be too lazy to send it back, but that I was too scrupulous to keep it. So, having no other choice, I did the show. And wherever I go, I'm the number one draw. And to this day, I'll never understand it, except to say that people are trying to make up for what they lacked in the university. We have so many people talking about practical, day-to-day issue-related stuff, which is important, but very few who are capable of unifying them all into theory, which is what academics do. So these 300 episodes we've covered in depth, so many aspects of Russia, Ukraine, and aspects of nationalism outside of those countries, and defended a set of ideas that are completely unique. I began an entire cottage industry around Vladimir Putin, and more generally, what his sort of rule means for a world run by the WTO and the Bilderbergs. I'm extremely proud of myself. I've done what all my professors said I could never do, that I could function, make a living as an academic outside of academia. They said this was impossible. Thanks to my listeners, thanks to people like Sven Longshanks and Mike Connor, I've done it. And I've done it without compromising anything. I discuss the topics that I want to talk about, the way that I want to talk about them, and there is absolutely no third party that comes in and gives me any... There's suggestions on occasion, but I do exactly what I want. No one in academia can say that. No one in journalism can say that. Even in the think tanks, you can't say that. People who are being paid directly can't be free. You have to be your own boss, so to speak, in order to be free. This is Thomas Jefferson's definition of freedom. If you're dependent on someone else for your livelihood, directly dependent, and especially if that dependency is very fragile, you're not a free man. And you certainly can't be said to own anything. And you can't be said to be trustworthy because you're so dependent. So for everyone who's donated to this radio show, I thank you. Some of you have been very generous. And the truth is that I don't need very much, but the bills, the divorce, taxes still have me up against the wall. And Sven Longshanks does so much work for free. Actually, all of his work for free. And it represents hundreds of hours of highly skilled labor. This is what makes a movement and a struggle what it is. It's not numbers, it's not media exposure, it's a handful of fanatics that won't stop until the job is done. So to my first producer, Mike Connor, to my longtime second producer, Sven Longshanks, I thank you very, very much. And especially to my listeners. And I'm very proud of this 300th milestone and the 10-year milestone as well. I had no idea this was going to work, but apparently it has. So I'm actually going to cover a topic that people have been bugging me to talk about for this last 10 years. And I don't remember exactly why I haven't done it. And that's the philosophy of Vladimir Soloviev. He is probably the best known Russian philosopher, probably equal to Berdyaev. If there's one philosopher that those outside of the Russia know, it's probably him. He's known for all the wrong reasons. Some people believe he's a Gnostic. Some people believe he was a Roman Catholic. People kind of want to read into whatever they feel like into his work. And the fact of the matter is, like any good Hegelian, he was a difficult person to read. His work was very dense, and you had to know the basics of German idealism, Hegel included, to be able to make sense out of it. Again, he uses that technical language that German idealism had kind of standardized. And I mean, by that, I mean, you know, Kant, Fichte, Schelling, Schlegel, the early romantics, and of course, Hegel. The other thing that makes it interesting is, as some of you know, my dissertation was on a critique of empiricism and positivism from the Hegelian point of view. In that case, the work of Michael Oakeshott of Cambridge University. Somewhat of a similar argument is being made here. My big concern is it's to debunk the myth that modern science is based on observation and experiment. Because it isn't. Every institution that exists has a mythology that justifies its existence. We all tell stories about ourselves. No one's innocent of it. But science is pretty outrageous in a lot of its claims. The scientific establishment in general is extremely wealthy. It controls almost every aspect of life. It's almost completely anonymous. And yet the image that it portrays is not reality. The very fact that people refer to science with a capital S as something that's real shows the power of this kind of suggestion. There is no such entity. There is no science. You have this ethereal view of objective secular men and looking at microscopes and being purely empirical and not allowing anything to interfere with their objectivity. And of course, we all know that's nonsense. These guys work for the government. They work for large corporations. And most of them are extremely non-creative. They're doing repetitive tasks over and over again for the major laboratories. Now here I'm talking about, you know, chemistry and biology. The very fact that it's really the foundation of modern biology, Charles Darwin, who created a theory without any evidence, was accepted anyway by this establishment, and then his acolytes had then go and try to collect as much evidence as possible to justify the theory. Then, of course, DNA was discovered 100 years later, and it's only through force and money that it's been able to survive that. Anyone who studies DNA and believes in Charles Darwin is a fool. You know, that's just pure dogma and nothing else there. And the fact that Darwinism survived the discovery of DNA in the late 40s proves that power and money, the so-called paradigm theory of Thomas Kuhn is essential. Kuhn, the structure of scientific revolutions, which every grad student in the social sciences has to read over and over again, talks about all the means whereby a dominant scientific paradigm is enforced. All except one. Money. And he's aware that he's leaving this out. There's no way he couldn't be. So in leaving that out, of course, he is contributing to this myth. But of course, he did some damage because the scientific myth was shattered here in the sense that, you know, scientists are created in a very dogmatic environment. They're raised to believe, raised, from late high school, college, grad school, in a certain series of non-negotiable axiomatic ideas. Not only in terms of the practice itself, but also its origins. And it's very, very difficult to dissuade them, especially when their money is dependent on this and their prestige is dependent on this. One of the funny things that's happening these days is that you see in all these content mills online, they'll make a claim about, some trite topic, which married couples are happiest according to science. Well, of course, it's social science. These aren't people in a laboratory. These are highly motivated, tenured liberals in their offices. There's no experiment. There's nothing like that. And of course, the assumption is that anyone who they interview or talk about is telling them the truth. And the more intimate the topic, the less chance there is that anyone's actually going to tell them the truth. Social scientific papers are a bit of a joke in that very little of it is quantitative. The theory that they are working on is the opposite, is qualitative. The argument is qualitative. How they define their variables is purely qualitative, and that's really most of the paper. Their analysis or the regression or whatever they're using is purely qualitative. All of it is. Except that one time where they hit the return on the computer and the regression analysis is spit out. Other than that, it's purely a matter of the humanities. Social science isn't science. But I don't like the idea of using science as some kind of a mystic entity, because that's what it is. It's a mystification. The very fact is that science doesn't use or talk about anything that's actually observable. Its tools are concepts, abstractions, forces, and of course, their ideological background. But the myth that's promoted to the popular science is that it's pure observation, experimentation, but it is purely a rationalist enterprise, to be honest with you. That's what it is. No one really denies this. But so long as they make enough iPhones, people are happy. I've spent so many years in grad school and after grad school attacking the concept of empiricism, nominalism, and positivism, whether it be from the British idealists and now from Vladimir Solovyev. They have a lot of ideas in common. But empiricism is weak. It's the weakest form of knowledge. Or I should say it's the lowest and least reliable form of knowledge. And speaking in the most general senses, first of all, the reality of the outside world can't be proven. It has to be taken on faith. What we're aware of is our sense impressions, which are only reducible to psychic states. We only know the states of our own mind. This doesn't mean there's anything actually out there. So if we call them sense impressions of the outside world, that doesn't prove anything. So empiricism is limited only to states of mind. And not any observation of the outside world. It's simply assumed that one lines up with the other. Secondly, all observation takes place in a context, which is what we've been talking about. Therefore, it's all conditioned. Whatever we take as important or significant, again, is not a quantitative enterprise. It's purely qualitative. Our states of mind, who's paying us, social pressure, and all kinds of instinctive or unconscious cultural norms dictate much of what science does, whether it be social science or otherwise. But the object itself, whatever it is that they're studying, whatever object in the world that they're studying, is itself problematic. The only thing that they could show at present is forces and energy, even though that would imply a non-material substratum. Any observable thing is really a collection of many particles of force or energy, and we could sense the effects, but not the forces themselves. This is taken for granted. When I see something, a botanist looks at a plant, what he sees only exists in his mind. His senses have made the colors brown and green with the elementary forces of the tree. The energies that are picked up by our mind is interpreted and made into colors and textures. So when I see an object and call it a thing, I'm behaving arbitrarily. Calling an object a single thing, it's false because it isn't. It's a collection of millions of pulses of force and energy. It's many, many things other than a single thing, which makes nominalism really a joke. Empiricism as a form of knowledge. Now we understand it has utilitarian value, but utilitarianism isn't knowledge. That's just something that works. That may or may not be true. Empiricism is an arbitrary approach to the world. And taking the existence of matter or of natural laws on faith is something they all have to do. Utilitarianism is really all they fall back on. And that really ends up meaning that their work can be turned into some kind of profit. But remember, Francis Bacon spoke of the New Atlantis, that this kind of method is going to eliminate want and hunger and oppression and return the world to its pre-lapsarian state, the high-tech Atlantean world. So there was great promise. But I think when World War I finally hit, the promises of the scientific establishment were seen to be what they truly were. The benefits, the utilitarian benefits of science are utilitarian because this is how we're born. We're born and raised and we expect certain things. The price that we pay for these things is very, very high. And when we have something new, an invention that does something for us, we forget how to do it ourselves. There is no progress because every time we move forward, we're forgetting something else. We're forgetting how to do something. Never at any time in history have people been so obese, so unhappy, so delusional about the world. Empiricism, though, knows only internal psychic states and nothing else. It's not really a form of knowledge at all. It's a very superficial approach to the world, which, of course, you know, it's perfect for today. But we really can't talk, even if you talk about energy, and Orthodox people talk about energy all the time, we can't see it or touch it, but we only know it through its effects. So ultimately, the only thing that makes any sense is to hold the ancient doctrine of essences or natures, Plato's forms, elementary forces that can't be seen or heard or sensed. And the things that we observe have to be reduced to what cannot be observed in order to make sense out of them. And this was Plato's essential point. Same thing for Augustine, Spinoza, Sclavarota, Russell. The true nature and foundation of reality is spiritual. Anything else falls under a contradiction. And the German idealists like Fichte and Hegel made a very similar point. The main book that I often refer to when dealing with Solovyev, is his Lectures on Divine Humanity, which was first published in 1878. It's probably his most difficult work, but it's most substantial statement of metaphysics. He is willing to reduce the external world to what Leibniz would call monads or atoms. They're elementary energies, so to speak, that they can't be observed. They're unchanging. They're the building blocks of all phenomenal being beyond space and time. But we know their effects because we see anything. They're another version of the essence, spiritual essence of existent things. An observation of anything, any X, is nothing. It's just a report of our sensation. But any X is a combination, too, of our internal psyche as well as whatever data from the outside is being fed into it. There would be no sound without hearing. Sound isn't in the sound waves, which would be the force in this case, but in the interpretation of these waves, both by the ear and, of course, ultimately the mind. But these inputs aren't created by us, so there has to be something given, something that we didn't create. The fundamental entities, anything, whatever you reduce the material world to, it can't be taken in and of itself because it has to function on a plane that permits them to function. Each atom has to have something essential in common with this field and one another. Now, when he says atom, you know, he's not referring to atoms in our sense. He's referring to spiritual building blocks of things. But the fundamental entities themselves, the monads or atoms, their relations to one another, and their relationship to the field in which they act, all three are related. So on the one hand, you could say that all these atoms, the building blocks of reality, phenomenal reality, they're mechanically related to one another, and they interact, and we could predict them, that they have a mutual affinity. But they are meant to interact, and they have a unity, they have an internal affinity based on their content. It's not just that they have this mechanical predictability, but they exist in a certain community, so to speak. They have an affinity one with another. In Lecture 10, Soloviev claims that space and time are the result of the fall of Adam. And he says this because they both operate on the principle of exclusion. Space, especially, is the nature, it results of from hostility. One object interacts with another, and they exclude one another. That's the ultimate principle of any kind of geometry. This is not a good thing. This exists because of sin. This exists because humanity is very limited. And the sin, not just of our sin, but the sin of the angels, has seeped into the daily functioning of the world around us. On the other hand, there's God. God contains all things, but prior to the act of creation, there's no distinction among those things. There's been no creation. He is purely simple. He's a pure substance. There is a will that he has to create, to manifest himself. So God reveals himself in thought. These are the forms in logos. The very thought himself, of course, is God. There's a separation between the forms of creation and the Father, who is their ultimate creator. The forms are a blueprint, so to speak, for creation, the archetypes. The nature found in Logos, the nature Christ carried with him. So there's the mind. Separate but not distinct from that is what the mind thinks. Since God's thought is in fact God, because it contains all he is, it is also God. Hence, Christ must be God, not only from scriptures and tradition, but also from metaphysics. Scientifically, it has to be the case. But having two entities, a duality like this, can't stand. It has to be resolved. The Holy Spirit is that third entity. Now, I'm acting like this is some kind of progression. It's not. But this is how we have to speak. Soloviev calls it the perception of the logos. Number three is significant because any two objects, so for example, we have the knower, someone, a scientist looking at an object, the object known isn't enough. Those two things have to exist within a field that's common to them both. The spirit is the energy or the manifestation of God in creation. One of the reasons that the Filioque is incorrect is that it denies the Father of the origin of all things. The Spirit doesn't work for the Son, so to speak. He gives energetic being to what the Father has created. You know, the Kabbalah, at least some schools, you know, like Leon Abiro, people like that, during the Renaissance, spoke of creation as the unity of the mother principle and the father principle in some kind of bizarre theology. And so much of the mentality in the Trinity comes from this. It seems just to make sense. You know, the Father is the Father, the Logos is the Son, and the Spirit is the Child. You do see this on occasion. And this is falsehood. The Spirit is directly from the Father, because the chain of creation, or the emanation of creation, is never severed from the Father. Now, emanation is a term that comes up in Plotinus and the Neoplatonists that denotes a lack of will, but Soloviev rejects this completely. God creates things because it's good that he do so. So Plotinus says that emanations are overflowing, that the one is so full of content that he overflows, and creation is thus inevitable. But God has no restriction. Putting things simply, the Father is the mind, the origin of all. The Son is what the mind thinks, and the Spirit is the presence that manifests both in the world. It doesn't manifest just the Son in the world, it manifests both in the world. Now, occasionally, Soloviev is charged with pantheism. Now, a lot of writers, including patristic writers, get accused of this. And I've struggled, I've looked high and low to find a pantheist somewhere, and I've never found one. No one believes that tree bark is God. And it can't be a part of God, because God doesn't have any parts. Pantheism, I'm going to mention Spinoza here in a minute, who was not a pantheist. Consistent pantheism is impossible. Or if you try to make it possible, you end up just being an atheist. So ultimately, pantheism is how Westerners have used what they think Hinduism is, or Buddhism is, to deny God and his law, but still claiming to be spiritual, claiming that God is everywhere and everything. So pantheism is really atheism from the point of view of full idealism. So consistent pantheism is impossible, although there are several mental institutions, I'm sure, who try to make it work. Now, more seriously, for Soloviev, so much of his work has to do with the fall, how man and the world was prior, in the prelapsarian state, and then, of course, after his sin. The state of creation, then, was ideal Platonic forms, so to speak, expressing and externalizing God's will that existed in pure harmony. Now, matter, and be careful with the word I'm using here, matter derives from the cosmic fall, a catastrophe. The Gnostic systems claim this, the Neoplatonists claim this, but we have to be very careful here. Matter, in that particular case, is referring to specific observable objects that provoke passion, not physicality. Matter refers to the world. Matter is, or material in this particular case, is the creation of sin. It's a manifestation of sin. We see an expensive car, and we envy the person who owns it. Well, never before have we envied the concept of a car, or the mathematical nature of its combustion engine. But the actual physical thing and what people will think of us because we have it. That's what we mean here. The Gnostics and the Orthodox differ radically on this point, and it's very easy to make that error. Matter, in the sense I'm using it, is a result of self-will. It's the desire to break free of the unity of God due to the belief that, in himself, we can craft an existence on our own, based on our own laws. It's not material creation as such. Matter is good in and of itself, but Lucifer's rebellion changes it. The great sin of Lucifer, Prometheus, Set, whatever, didn't create matter, but it set the stage whereby the separation between levels of reality became possible. And from that moment, creation began to devolve. Slowly but surely, everything fell apart. I don't believe in evolution, I believe in devolution. I've said this many, many times. And you see this in most ancient civilizations, referring to a golden age, and then they speak of the devolution all the way up to the Iron Age, in which, of course, we live. This is essential to Roman thinking, and you see this elsewhere. The devolution continued until the coming of Christ, but even there, outside of the church, it continues today, and has reached ludicrous proportions. Now, Gnostics will deliberately equivocate and confuse a phenomenal world with the fallen state of creation. The fallen state, in other words, physical objects that provoke the passion, and that can be used to control people. That material world is only damaged because people are. There's nothing inherently evil with a Lamborghini. The problem is, in the sense that it's wasteful. And it's stupid. No one needs one, and it's just to get people to admire you. But in and of itself, the engineering and the color and that's not a problem. It has no moral content. The material world is only damaged because people are. Lucifer seeks to dominate it and rearrange it towards his interests. He, of course, can't make matter as God can, but he can rearrange it and pretend he's creating it. Now, the prelapsarian world is called Sophia by Solovyov and Bulgakov. And in that sense, it's a harmless idea. All they mean in that sense, Sophia is just the state of the material world in Eden, or matter receiving the form of the divine. Now, beyond that, it's a problem. But Sophia has been a devotion. It's the main cathedral in Kiev. There's many icons of it. There are many Gnostics who attempted to attack the church with it. But I don't believe that either Bulgakov or Solovyov meant anything heretical by the notion of Sophia. We can't talk about that right now. But that's what it is, in this sense. It's a feminine concept. It's the state of the material world prior to the sin of Lucifer, and then prior to the sin of Adam. But man sinned. He was tempted by what the apple represented, the lures of an autonomous existence outside natural and divine law. This is what tempted Adam and Eve. But this devolution has reached a critical point. There's waves, the ebbs and flows, but it gets worse. The reconstruction can only come from orthodoxy. Not only is it the only tradition that retains the canonical tradition of the ancient church, but takes into itself both Eastern and Western philosophical traditions. So, Solovyov calls the phenomenal world abnormal, as does Skovorod and so many others. Not because it's material, but because it's damaged due to sin. Gnostics have always liked to claim Solovyov and Skovorod and so many others, but he denied any connection to the movement. He remained orthodox despite his many eccentricities in that respect. Now, by the way, as an aside, there's a few Roman Catholics who would love to believe that he converted. He never did. He did receive communion from a Uniate priest in 1896. However, this was not done quite explicitly in leaving orthodoxy. He didn't take ecclesial structures very seriously. His letters reject any conversion to the Roman Church. He really was a member of both and neither. In 1897, a year after that, he took confession from the Orthodox priest, Father Ivanov Platonov, who was a teacher at the academy. And he got into an argument with him over the nature of the Roman Church. But at the very end of his life, which is, you know, he died the same year as Nietzsche, 1900, he rejected that. And he said the disagreement that he had was based on pride and arrogance, and that he was wrong. So he never converted to Catholicism. He just really didn't think that at the time the barrier between the two churches meant anything. So his orthodoxy was highly eccentric, as was Berdyaev's. That doesn't mean he's not useful in a lot of ways. The material world is, if you want to think about it chronologically, it's the final manifestation of the forms as their physical expression. But that's only in their prelapsarian state, the state prior to the sin of Adam. Now, physical things are interrelated to all other physical things, to each other as well as to spiritual things. The concept of beauty is a connection of those things with the one common form, not forcibly imposed, but interacting freely. So when something interacts with the form in which it was created voluntarily and with full understanding of the concept, that's what beauty is. You know, the representation of any object, I don't care if it's a natural object or a human being or someone in a particular state of mind, it has to come under the form in which it was created and manifest it in some significant way. Not in a purely realistic way, but in a way that shows its manifestation. It shows the form, which is really what art is, the form shines through the content. The form is the definition, the structure of the thing. It's eternal. The content is the physical nature of the thing. So really what, you know, Soloviev is saying is that all of world history is the attempt, our struggle, to return the world to the state, to bring things under their natural forms, rather than, in the industrial world, the belief that you could recreate nature. And empiricism, the way it's structured, justifies and takes as essential the existence of sin. It understands only separate objects, and these are defined arbitrarily, as the foundation of everything. This is the problem. It's dialectical. The reality is the restoration of unity between the finite creation and the absolute creator, and this is done through the forms. This is why nations are important. There's no abstract man. But there's also no individual man. The nation serves as a form, a language, a tradition, the culture, the field in which a man can operate. This is why art is national, because there is no abstract human being. Although in the modern world, of course, it's based entirely on the existence of abstractions. The man has value in himself, but this is manifest only as part of the form of God, the intermediate forms of natural law. God is the ultimate end, but to get there, we have the forms of natural law, divine law, civil law. And this is why, to me, the Synod of Chalcedon is the central event of European history. This was entered into a canonical truth in the Church and for everyone else. Our capacity to stand on our own is very, very poor. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be independently choosing where we go. No one can force you to come to God, in other words. No one can force you to be a patriot. No one can force you to be anything. Now, maybe for younger people, you know, as they're learning, it's a different story. But a fully free, rational person, that's simply impossible. In other words, Empiricism is false because it implies that something can be known outside of its necessary relations with other phenomena, through its form. Reason is a part of the natural order because only by reason can this be manifest to us. It's a matter of thought. It's not given an experience. Experience is nominal by its very structure. Reason is a principle of unity. Now, I'm not talking about rationalism. That's a perversion of this concept, and it only shows the bare form of the truth. So both empiricism and rationalism, which never really differed from one another, are both false. The truth of our reason is true because reason is within the reality that we're trying to study. Reason isn't just something in our minds. It exists in the created world, and that is logos. So many of the simple distinctions in textbooks are false and overdrawn. The so-called rationalist-empiricist debate didn't exist. Empiricists didn't deny there has to be a rational foundation to observation. No rationalist ever said that you don't have to see anything to learn it. We can just go entirely by logic every day of our lives. This is ridiculous. It's the same thing from two different points of view. But here's the problem. I mean, this is, you know, Westerners see this, you know, either we think in deductive terms or inductive terms. Immanuel Kant described the manifold of experience, the sense data that in and of itself is meaningless, until it comes under the form, a priori categories. But he never spoke of that third entity. Anything that we see and understand, we have to bring under a form. When we see an adult crying and screaming and carrying on, we're repulsed by this. When we see a baby doing the same, we're not. Well, they're both human beings, but one's brought under the form of childhood, the other one's brought under the form of adulthood. And that contains very specific content. The notion of an adult crying and carrying on and demanding to be fed and everything else, that repulses us. It's ugly. It's a very, you know, it's a manifestation of ugliness. It's something opposed to its form. Homosexual behavior is ugly because it's opposed to its form. It isn't sex. They can't have sex. It's just masturbation in some disgusting places. It's not sexual. It's not love. It may be friendship, but it's ugly. And it's ugly because it is the perversion of something, the misuse of something. An object brought under a form not its own. But Hegel did solve the problem. So Nikolai Lvovsky, one of my favorite Russian philosopher of the 20th century, says this: empiricism leaves us with nothing but appearances, without an object of which they are appearances, and without a subject to whom they appear. Rationalism ends with pure thought, that is, thought without a thinker, without anything to think of. Neither sensation nor thought can prove the existence of anything or give any knowledge. So get more specific here. In Lecture 2, Soloviev says this: only the whole exists. Truth, then, is the whole. If truth be the whole, then that which is not the whole, any particular thing, being, or event taken separately from the whole, is not true. Because in its separateness, it does not even exist. It exists all and with all. Truth, then, is all in the unity or as one. The complete definition of truth thus finds expression in three predicates: is, one, and all. Well, that's Lvovsky's translation. Truth, in other words, is not a quality, but it's a concrete aspect of being itself. He continues: the absolute, that is God, as the pan-unity, cannot be wholly external to the knowing subject. There must be an inner connection between them, by virtue of which the absolute can be known to the subject, and the subject can be inwardly connected with all that exists in the absolute and actually know this all. It is only in connection with that which truly is as with the unconditionally real and unconditionally universal, that the facts of our experience acquire any true reality, and the concepts of our thought true, positive, universality. Taken in the abstract, both these factors of our knowledge are themselves completely indifferent to truth, and derive their true significance from a third, a religious principle. In other words, ultimately, if one believes that knowledge derives either from the empirical or the rationalistic method, or deduction-induction, by its own, the only thing you're left with is relativism and nihilism. And both of these, especially empiricism, imply nominalism. Externally, an individual thing with no relation to anything else. But what Soloviev is saying here is that without relations, without its relation to anything else, it's not an object. I saw this not that long ago. I was in a museum in Pittsburgh, art museum in Pittsburgh, and I saw a photorealist, I forget who it was, exhibit. And, you know, these people are usually crazy, you know. And one was a stapler by itself. Now, initially I laughed. I said, you know, what, you get paid for this? But I started to wonder. And in fact, it began to bother me. It's a stapler completely without context. It's not near anything. There's nothing else in the picture. It's not in an office or in a home. It's just there by itself. Therefore, it's not a stapler. It can't be. In order for it to be a stapler, it has to exist in context. It's one thing, it has to look like it and do the same operations that a normal stapler does. But that's not enough. It also has to be in that environment. A stapler at the bottom of an ocean also is not a stapler. It may just look like one, but it isn't one. But taking this more abstractly, it comes from seeing things from the point of view put it this way. The way Soloviev uses the word faith means the intuition of the all. In order for anything to have any meaning, it has to be related to everything else. Immediate apprehension. So his Trinitarian theology, as I've mentioned, is based on the self-manifestation of the absolute. As I've said already, just to make sure this is clarified here, the manifestation of being itself, then the manifestation of being for another, then the expression of it, and then finally the return to the Creator. The first is being, the second truth, the third is beauty, to use philosophical terms. And then all of these in Soloviev are forms of love. Love is defined as the inward unity of multiplicity. Beauty and love are extremely closely connected. Truth is love in the sense that it unifies objective thought. Beauty is love that's sensed and understood. It's not the formal relations, it's a sensate relation. Epistemological categories are always ethical ones. These may seem abstract, but they're deeper than that. God manifests goodness in the world through truth and beauty. That's why he created anything. The Trinity, ethically speaking, is a multitude of creatures that only attain fullness by forming a single whole, a living organism. And you can see what we mean here. We derive this unity as men from the family, the nation, and of course the church. The drive, the struggle is to go from an unthinking mechanical unity, which is not really a unity at all, to a free, negotiated, voluntary unity without sacrificing anything. I've said on this show many times the difference between a communist collective and a commune. They're complete opposites. A commune is an organic, ancient institution. Not just of families that have known each other for many generations, but in a certain area. Knowing the region very, very well. Having a deep connection with the region. Their forebears literally become the soil. This is something, they don't even need to think. They love one another without even having to consider it, like a child loves its mother. The collective is something opposite. The Soviets were very threatened by the commune. Anything organic was a perversion to these people. They hated it. Everything had to be mechanistic and artificial. And the Gnostic side of Marxism is just that. Nature is this horrible thing. We need to replace it. The tikkun olam. The concern is, they went the complete opposite way. The perversion, ugliness, is to take a community and turn it into a collective. And of course, it always has to be done by force. For us, the drive is to do the opposite. The healthy, the beautiful thing to do is to take alienated, sick people and slowly but surely allow them to understand that their life, their personhood, everything about themselves can only really find any true meaning in a community. Not just any community. Community of the truth. The nation and its historical understanding, the church, the region, and especially the extended family. I've used the word absolute here, and in the 19th century this was done quite often. It's the unity of everything that is. But it's more than that. The one of Plotinus, the Neoplatonists. It's not simply the collection of everything that is. Because the word is a problem. The absolute first principle, it transcends any kind of content or even any kind of form. This is why God can never be proven. Because he is the reason why any proof can exist at all. Condition both content and form and bind them together. That inner bond remains above all determination. But of course, determinate existence is always relative and contingent. The first principle, the one, the absolute, God the Father, is above existence, is above power. It creates those things. That's why it's extremely difficult to even talk about, except to the extent that we understand it through our very limited reason. But it's incommensurable with any determinations. And nothing in the human sense. That's because it's beyond being. He says, the absolute is all and nothing. Nothing insofar as it is not any one thing, and all insofar as it cannot be lacking in anything. Which, by the way, is the definition of perfect. Not flawless, but not needing anything. Individual existence, a nominal existence, is relative. And therefore, in relation to God, is alien. It can't be wholly alien, of course, because there's no boundaries in God. So he says, the absolute, therefore, is the unity of itself and its opposite, insofar as it is the denial of itself and the affirmation of its other, it is love. And that comes actually from Lossky. So two poles are distinguished here. Two sides. The first, the principle of absolute unity and freedom from any determination. And the other, multiplicity. The one and the many. The first is really only the positive potentiality of being. And the latter is purely negative. The latter is what we mean by the material world. Now nothing, there is no such thing as a pure multiplicity that can't exist. There is pure unity, but that's beyond our comprehension. Man, at his best, will not be satisfied with anything but absolute knowledge. And it's true that moderns are mired in utilitarianism. The best minds, the true mind, can never not be restless This is what is the central concept in St. Augustine. Truth as such, beyond contingency, beyond determination, is the only thing that could satisfy somebody. Otherwise, it's all just changing and, you know, what's here today is gone tomorrow. That's not knowledge. Anytime you talk about patterns and laws, you're talking about something beyond the actual things that it governs. So in moral terms, the things of the world can only rise up to God if they have perfect love. We use terms like love, you know, this vocabulary is very specific. The word love, as I've said 100 times, has been so abused and mocked in this society that I hate using it. And so when you read, you know, the New Testament or the Church Fathers talking about love, you think of some saccharine Hallmark BS. But at an absolute minimum, it refers to the complete renunciation of self-assertion. And the truth is, it leads not to the loss of individuality, but to the finding of it. It loses individuality, but it finds personhood. You find your true self into a perfect life in God. Individuality, in the egocentric sense, is the pathology of powerlessness. So satanic being is the opposite. It's the realm of self-assertion based on chaos, the opposite of stable knowledge. You see this in ancient Egypt with the god Set, from whence we get Satan, or Set Amun. So if you reject voluntary obedience to God, that is the truth, man becomes a slave to passion, and he's changed forever. If you reject natural law, you don't then begin thinking logically and rationally. Why would you? You then become indulgent. And so man himself changes. You change over time. And nature changes as well. He says, beings that preserve egoistic exclusiveness become impenetrable to one another. They acquire corporeality in the form of coarse matter, which admits of external relations only and not of inward unity. The life of beings that separated one from another inevitably ends in death. The relations between them are almost entirely confined to the struggle of existence, for existence, which necessarily involves suffering and can never lead to satisfaction, since the fullness of being is not to be found on this path. That's an essential programmatic statement that I think unifies everything that I've been saying up until this point. Now, this is the, you know, upper reaches of metaphysics. So matter in this sense is coarse. He says coarse matter in the sense that it's created by sin and manifests sin. And Slovius' case, and again, this is a bit outdated, but he's using atoms as one of this part of this coarse matter. He's talking in qualitative, not quantitative terms. So our task, of course, is to overcome all forms of evil and imperfection, self-consciously, which derives from the same impenetrable corporeality that he refers to, and to further the process of reunion of creatures with one another and then, of course, to God. But to do this, to make any sense out of it, you know, it sounds just like a silly cliche, but it requires self-sacrifice. But there is no self-sacrifice without love. It can't be accomplished by man alone. It does belong to God. But man manifests Christ's own passion in giving up himself, in pursuing the truth in a sick society. You end up like me. You end up marginal. And on the one hand, that's a positive thing. You have a clear conscience. On the other hand, it's very, very difficult to function. To be honest and to be truthful is a very hard life. Lying is so easy. And, you know, over time, you get used to it. Now, the incarnation is the ultimate form of self-sacrifice. Even before the crucifixion of the garden, the creator of all things descends into this multiplicity, This is beyond any asceticism that we could ever engage in. Now, of course, we can never go back to the innocence of Eden. Unfortunately, it's gone forever. So any new unity has to be rational. The natural order is really a perfect example of unity and multiplicity, like the human body. As I've said before, I mentioned the stapler. Same thing. Think of in the human body, a lung. A lung is only such when it's in a living, functional human body. If you held one in your hand, it's not a lung anymore. It's just a lump of tissue that kind of looks like one. But this is a model here. This is a form of manifestation of the logos. You have to start at the lower levels. Of course, we have to be alive. We have to feed ourselves, the basic needs and wants. Then reason can occur. Reason can develop. In the way Soloviev builds it over the history of the planet, this organic natural process that once the, because he believes in evolution or a very specific type of evolution, the logos takes all levels of reality into a massive pan-unity of being. Now, his version of evolution, again, this is in the 1880s, he liked the idea that reason is the result of struggle, that the unity of the chemical and biological, even in geological elements of the world come first. And that serves as a model for later on. When man develops and then eventually develops reason, reason has to follow the same path. He sees evolution because he's looking at the moral categories underneath it. The evolutionary process for him is something that creates the conditions for the expression of reason and logos. It has an ideal foundation and function, which, of course, Darwin would never recognize. Well, I can't believe it's I've gone over my time. I've gotten to less than half of what I want to do. Before I go, by the way, I'm going to be speaking at Freedom Palooza this year. In Pennsylvania. This is a festival, 3 days. It's like a right-wing Woodstock. I mean, that's actually a really good way of putting it. Paul Tapiti of Poker Face, the band, is an old friend of mine. I've known him for many years. I trust him. He's a good guy, family man. And he's been running this for a long time. And like all of us, he suffered greatly. If he were a mainstream musician, talking about what the regime wants him to talk about, he'd be a millionaire today. It's like I'd be a tenured professor somewhere. But because we follow the truth, we suffer. And if you look up Freedom Palooza and Poker Face online, I strongly invite you to come. It's a big deal. It's always especially more than ever, this is the Woodstock of our struggle. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that before I forgot. So I went over my time here a little bit. There's so much here to be done. Just to conclude here, and I've said this before, the essential concept comes down to the Synod of Chalcedon in the 5th century. Chalcedon proved the true balance of our human nature and our human struggle and human society with the divine. God made us rational, therefore free, and free only to the extent that we're rational. The Monophysites were incorrect because it left no room for that. It absolutely left no room for that. Divinity absorbed everything else, as atheism does the opposite. And at the time, this is how it was understood in the Greek language. It's so central to European history because it posited the notion that in Christ, the divine nature didn't dominate the human one. It functioned as two individual entities voluntarily united. Even when Christ went to the garden, it was voluntary. When he was crucified, it was voluntary. He really didn't have to do that, but that was his mission from the Father. Chalcedon made the argument that I'm making in this presentation, Slovia's idea that beauty and truth, pretty much one and the same thing, is when any object comes under its governing form. This is the essential thing. This is what natural law is all about. You really don't need a Bible for this kind of thing. You don't need religion for that kind of thing. It's inherent to reason alone, or by itself, I should say. But it should only come under that form voluntarily. It shouldn't do it without thinking. It shouldn't do it by force. It shouldn't do it out of habit. And those things that are essential and very important, it has to be done with some kind of what we would say today informed consent. And I mean that in a very broad sense. Beauty and truth is the object or relationship coming under the form that governs it. And for us, it's coming into the church and understanding what we're doing. So we may be baptized as babies, which of course is the ancient practice, but our entire life is a constant renewal of this. And we can leave at any time. And people do, usually because it's too hard. But at least we know that it's voluntary. Those that are here, especially today, those that are here at a time of great suffering, where it's in nobody's interest to struggle for the truth, you know that these people are mean what they say. As I've said many times before, we're simply better stock than our enemies because they have everything handed to them. We have to struggle for it. Nothing can be done by habit or force. We come to this because we know it to be true, or at the least, we trust someone who understands it to be true. This is what Chalcedon was, the most significant event in European history. The voluntary connection of human nature with a divine nature. Not a habitual one, not a forceful one. Bringing things under its form, bringing an object under its form is to, let's just unify it, but to bring under natural law and to bring it to itself. That's its very identity. That's its very definition. And it matters. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.